Well, welcome everybody to the Commonwealth Club. My name is Patrick O'Reilly. I'm the chair of the Psychology Forum. And incidentally, some question cards were passed out. So if you have any questions for Mr. Farrell, please fill them out, and Renee in the back will collect them towards the end of the meeting. And it is with great pleasure that I introduce Mr. Mike Farrell to the Commonwealth Club tonight. I've admired his acting for years. MASH stands out as one of my all-time favorite shows. And he's a Marine Corps veteran, an author, and a social activist. And for those of us who are opposed to the death penalty, Mr. Farrell has been a beacon of light as president of Death Penalty Focus. And he's very much deserving of our respect and admiration. So please welcome Mr. Farrell.
Thank you very much for being here. It's very kind of you. And I don't want to you to infer from Patrick's statement that anybody who supports the death penalty is not welcome. Please, I'm somebody always accuses me of preaching to the converted, and sometimes the converted need to be preached to. But I enjoy meeting people who disagree and finding out why and discussing the issue in general. But let me start by saying, is this too loud? Okay, fine. The artwork on your the walls, photographs, are very impressive, and they're particularly impressive if you read at the back of the statement of the photographer and the letter he found. They are photographs taken in the what was called the killing zone or the deadly zone at Chernobyl after a number of years. And I found them very moving, but I found particularly moving a statement he wrote, and I wanted to just start off by reading it. In reference to that, but I think it refers to many things, he says, I'm assuming he means civilizations, our most crowning achievement has been the ability to provide a better life, a better world, in any aspect for posterity. It is a principal goal to work tirelessly to leave a legacy that can provide something positive for future generations. I think that's a wonderful observation, and for me, it helps me start off by saying that I think what we're talking about here tonight, the death penalty, capital punishment, state killing, whatever you prefer to think of it as, the question of whether or not we should have this process in this country is really about what kind of society we are and what kind of a society we aspire to be. I have been involved in this issue for many, many years, and over time I've watched a kind of metamorphosis, not always a positive one, in our society. Please come in. You're welcome. Sit wherever you can find a place. In the 50s and the 60s in this country, public opinion polls generally showed that Americans opposed the use of the death penalty up until 1972, when it was abolished, essentially, by the United States Supreme Court. It was held to be cruel and unusual, as they put it, the way lightning strikes are cruel and unusual. It was the point was made that one could be get the death penalty for a crime that in one part of the country where he couldn't get it in the other part of the country for the same act. Even in some death penalty states, that was the case and is today. So in 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that we could no longer kill our citizens. Over the 30-plus years I've been involved in this issue, when we started out, trying to begin to convince people, because in 1976 the court reinstituted the death penalty when the state, I think it was Georgia, came to them with a program for the death penalty that they felt met constitutional concerns by providing a particularly very serious protections for the accused and trying to avoid this business of kind of lightning strike irregularity. Over the same period of time, when we started out, about 40 countries in the world of the 160 or 70 nations, states in the world, had given up the use of the death penalty. The rest continued to use it. In that period of time, internationally, there has been a very serious shift. As the United States became more involved with using the death penalty, the international community became less involved with using the death penalty, to the degree that today 135, I believe it is, nations in the world have given up the use of the death penalty, either in law or in practice. Some still have it on the books but simply don't use it, and most have given it up in law. And the ones who continue to use it, the ours is the only advanced Western nation that continues to kill its own citizens. And of the ones that whose company we find ourselves in are nations like China and Pakistan and Saudi Arabia and Iran and Iraq and countries that on other levels in terms of human rights concerns, we find ourselves not in company. So it becomes a kind of odd situation for us. And when one looks at it, it seems fairly clear to me that what happened in this country is that my own theory is that when politicians found that they couldn't inspire fear in the people's minds and hearts by calling people communists anymore, they had to find another thesis. And the other thesis they found was permissiveness or criminality. And they began to talk about being tough on crime. And the way in which one could most dramatically demonstrate how tough one was on crime was to be willing to kill. And at first it was not the majority, and then it became the majority, and then it became even people, in my experience, people in the political world who opposed the use of the death penalty began to be afraid to speak out in opposition to the death penalty because they could then be pointed out and accused of being soft on crime, and that was a great way to lose your seat on the California Supreme Court, for example, or offices in state offices or in federal offices. So the epithet of being soft on crime became something that was to be avoided because we had to begin to show how tough we were on crime, and people lined up to do so. And in my experience, what resulted was a kind of development of a retributive society to the degree that over time we've now come to the point where the United States of America, the beacon of hope for the rest of the world in the eyes of many people, has more people in prison behind bars than any other nation in the world. 2.3 million people are behind bars in the United States. Over 3,000 of them are in chambers that are considered the chambers for the condemned, people who are sentenced to death and will die in the various state execution chambers. As you probably know, we started by I suppose we've always had the firing squad, but we started mostly by hanging people, and then we converted to, I believe, the electric chair and then to the gas chamber. And over time, each one was demonstrated to be not the humane way to end a life. The struggle has always been in this society to live up to our standards of belief that people are valuable. How do you end a life in a humane way if that's not a contradiction in terms, and in my view, of course, it is. I believe it's wrong to take a life. However, there are those whose moral philosophy is such that suggests that it's okay under certain circumstances for the state to take a life. So the argument or the discussion then, it seems to me, is not about my morality is higher than yours or shouldn't be, but it really is about what do we aspire to be as a society? And if you believe that it's okay for the state to take a life, Then I think what we need to do is make a determination as to what the process should be and how do we go about it. And do we live up to a humane standard that, or the humane standard that I would hope this country would aspire to? If you look at our system, I mentioned earlier that the United States Supreme Court held the act unconstitutional in 72 on the basis of a number of things. But it was challenged on the basis of race. It was challenged on the basis of a number of things. But primarily what the thesis they used was that it didn't meet constitutional standards because of the freakishness of its application. But today, what we find is all of the arguments that were being used to attack the death penalty in 72 are still with us. The question of race is a very serious one. Here in this country, we have a problem, as we most of us know, a history of racial discrimination, a history of slavery and segregation and Jim Crow, that picked out specifically the black population, but it also extends, I think, to people of color in general. And we find a disproportionate number of people of color are subject to the death penalty, even in a situation wherein the crime and the viciousness of the crime can be the same. If it's a white perpetrator, it's different. The response is quite often different from a jury than it is a black perpetrator or a brown perpetrator. So we find ourselves in this odd situation. I mentioned the 2.3 million figure of people incarcerated. What that works out to be is one in every 100 American males is either incarcerated or in the thrall of the criminal justice entity, whether it's parole, probation, or what have you. Of those 100 American males, white men 18 or over are one in every 106. Hispanic men 18 years or older are one in every 36. Black men 18 years or older are one in every 15. Black men between the ages of 20 and 24 are one in every 9. That to me is the description of a social failure, that we in our society have lost our way if we are so willing to discriminate in this process. And it is worrisome to me that a lot of people have heard these figures over years or heard generally that interestingly, it's not just black perpetrators, but if you look at the victim, a white victim is more likely to result in a capital conviction than is a black victim. In other words, people of color are not considered quite so meaningful as people, as white people in this society. So we have this continued process that is racialized, and yet the public in general has been bulldozed into believing that the death penalty, still tainted as it is necessary. Then if you look at it economically, you find that virtually, I always think of the fact that one of the popes said that Catholics should have a preferential option for the poor. And yet, here in America, the death penalty is almost the exclusive option of the poor. You don't see rich people who can afford a dream team to defend them getting the death penalty. Most of our people, on the thousands I've mentioned that are on death row, are poor people, people who couldn't afford an attorney at all and therefore had one provided either through those states that have them, a public defender system, or states that don't have one, a court-appointed attorney, who quite often is not trained in capital defense, and therefore these people are quite often sort of put through the mill and sent to death row. The result of that, of course, becomes very interesting. So you've got the social problem of racism and you've got the social problem of poverty that provides us most of the people on death row. But then you look at the situation and you find that the courts have imposed this system of, as a result of the challenge in 72 and the replacement of the institution in 76, the courts imposed these protections for the accused. To the degree that it has become a very interesting process, and a tremendously expensive process to go through the necessary steps to meet the constitutional demands of the United States Supreme Court, convict somebody, and sentence that person to death. Then, as most people know, the court requires that they go through a series of appeals through the state system, and once the state system is exhausted, then through the federal system. And here in California, we have a situation which is particularly interesting. We have the largest death row in the country, over 714 people. I think it's at this point 714 or 715 people reside on our death row. We have not executed anybody in the last 6 years because of a legal challenge that resulted in effectively a judicially imposed moratorium that will now, we're told, last until throughout 2012 because the state's process has not been able to solve the legal problems that are attached to our death penalty. So we have actually executed 13 people since the state became a death state again in 1978. And a study was just recently done. I'm getting ahead of myself in terms of cost, but a study was just recently done that suggests that, and this study was done by a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals jurist who supports the death penalty, and a law professor who is opposed to the death penalty. The two of them simply examined the system and got access to significant numbers of facts and came up with the fact that we have spent $4 billion to maintain and use our death system in the state of California since 1978, and we have succeeded in executing 13 people. The breakdown of that says it has cost us over $300 million per execution. Now, this in a state that had, last time I looked, a $20 billion budget deficit, and trying to figure out how to use how to parse that so that we can take away teachers and police officers and classrooms and food from hungry children. And it is called the Aller, if anybody wants to look it up, it's called the Alarcon Mitchell Report that said this $4 billion expenditure. Says we spend $184 million every year to maintain our death penalty system, whether we use it or not, over and above what it would cost or does cost to put somebody in prison for the rest of his or her natural life without the possibility of parole and to stay there. And effectively what we're talking about are two systems. One is a system wherein the state puts somebody to death. The other is a system where somebody dies in prison. They both die in prison, one by natural causes, the other by the act of the state. One costs us $184 million more than the other. Becomes a question of economic silliness on some level, although the term silliness shouldn't apply when we're talking about people taking lives. So what we found is that in this system that is deeply flawed on the basis of race and deeply flawed on the basis of poverty, we also find that it is simply making mistakes. When these cases go through the appellate process, through the state and the federal appellate process, about 60% of them are turned over and sent back down, not in the state, not in our state. 90%+ are passed on and the Supreme Court says they're fine, but when they get into the federal system, they're turned back. And the people are told either to retry this individual or do the portion of the trial that determines whether or not the convicted individual should get death or life without parole. And so some 60% of them come back and are reconfigured on that basis. I mentioned 13 people that have been executed. In fact, 92 people have died on California's death row. 13 were executed, one was executed out of the state, and the others died either of natural causes or suicide, or 9 of them by violence committed by another inmate. So people are dying on a death row, but the vast majority of them, not by the hands of the state, except for the fact that they are incarcerated and put in a condition, in a situation where that results. So we have This process that I described about the appellate process and the things that go on. But in it, what we have found is that of the 1,200 people who have been executed over time, and the 3,000 that remain on our death rows, 139 have been, after having been tried, convicted, sentenced to death, and in some instances spent years waiting for the executioner, have been found to be not properly convicted, innocent, and or, for whatever reason, exonerated. So 139 of those people are walking our streets today, those who haven't perished outside, which has demonstrated, I was part, my organization actually was a co-sponsor of an organization, of a an event in at the Northwestern Law School in 1998, the Center for the Center for Wrongful Convictions, which showed at that time 33 of the then, I think the number was 70-plus people who had been wrongly convicted and sentenced to death and ultimately freed, and 33 of them came up on a stage and spoke about the fact and said that if the state of California had had its way, I would be dead today. The state of Texas had its way. The state of Missouri had its way. The state of Florida had its way. They went through this litany, and it was very impressive. And it brought the attention not only of the United States media, but also the media from around the world to this question of wrongful convictions. Now, that was 1998. Today, as I said a minute ago, wrongly convicted people who have been released from our prison, from our death rows, are number 139, and it's happening more all the time. There are two men who have been recently released. They were not on death row, but they were convicted for murder here in California, released for being wrongly convicted after 20 years in prison, after, in one case, over 20 years in prison. So the problems then become, for those people who do believe that the system is appropriate, that the state should have the right to kill, the problem, it seems to me, becomes how do you do it fairly? How do you do it appropriately? And if you cannot do it fairly and appropriately, how can you continue it? How can you support it? The other question that's come up most recently, and I mentioned the amounts of money, this business of $184 million a year here in the state of California is not unique to California. Every state that is a killing state in the country today has found that it costs two to three or more times more to go through the process and execute somebody than it does to simply have a trial for life without parole and keep that person incarcerated for an average of 40 years. So the cost, over years of talking about race and years of talking about poverty and years of talking about wrongful convictions and years about talking about the problems in the system, inherent in the system, problems with overzealous prosecutors who tend to hide exculpatory evidence, evidence that might have proven the created some problem for their conviction, or police and prosecutors who are simply zealously doing their jobs and are pressed by the community's passion or by some other outside force that simply makes for slipshod prosecutions. The problems that exist in the system need to be addressed. And until and unless they're addressed, I don't frankly understand how anybody can support this system, and yet people continue to. And I think it's because they're afraid. They're afraid, and we all are afraid, of having some treacherous murderer loose on the streets. Nobody wants to see that. But if you look at the 139 people who are walking our streets today that did not commit the crime that they were sentenced to death for, the argument then suggests that there's somebody else out there who did and is still walking the streets. So what we have to do is have a system that works, and we have to have a system that is fair, and we have to have a system that makes sense. And in my view, capital punishment cannot make sense, and it cannot be fair because we are human beings and we make mistakes. Some people simply make errors. And when errors are made and people die as a result, what we don't know is of those 130 or beyond the 139 who are walking the streets today, how many were innocent and yet were among the 1,200 plus who have been executed? We know of some, but that's an uncomfortable fact for jurisdictions, for governors, for people in these positions of power to deal with, the issue of having executed an innocent person. I think of it as an institutional imperative to deny that possibility. We have a particular Supreme Court justice, Justice Antonin Scalia, who says that no innocent person has been executed. Well, how he knows that, I don't know. When facts have pointed out that there are two, three people in Texas that are, there's very good evidence that suggests that they were innocent when they were killed, and there's a man in Missouri who arguments are made about his innocence, and there are people in California, of course, some of whom have been exonerated, but others who have died, and the question remains as to whether or not they were guilty of the crime for which they were convicted. So we as a society, it seems to me, have a problem. And it's one here in California that we are beginning to address. It has been addressed and addressed successfully over time now, primarily because of the cost issue. State legislatures and governors are now beginning to say, you know what, maybe we need to take another look at this question. Where we had up until in 1976 when the Supreme Court re-ratified the death penalty. There were 12 states that continued to not kill their citizens. And interestingly enough, studies have shown that of the then, 36 that did have, 38 that did were killing states, that people talk about the deterrence. The capacity for deterrence, or the fact of deterrence. If somebody is executed for a crime, it'll deter a would-be killer because he or she will be afraid of being executed. In fact, studies have shown that cities in non-killing states with the same demographic breakdown as cities in killing states are less violent than the city in the killing state. So the idea, it seems to me, of deterrence has been demonstrably shown to be false. The idea that we somehow do ourselves a favor by eliminating, one district attorney I debated said that person doesn't deserve to live. Well, I don't know how one makes that determination. I mean, certainly there are people committing egregious crimes, and if you separate that person from society and put him or her in a place where every waking moment is controlled by the guards and the prison and the circumstances of his or her life, some argue that's not much of a life, but it certainly is not going to be one that is somebody is going to feel good about having to live for the rest of his or her years. As I said, I believe it's wrong to kill, and I would go further. I believe that the greatest problem in our society today, and with regard to the use of the death penalty, is that it is doing great damage to the moral fabric of our society. And there are some who simply don't understand that, don't accept it, or whatever, believe I'm going too far in so saying. But let me just say that at the in the early stages of World War II, the German army would capture, as we know, Jews and gypsies and homosexuals and collaborators and communists and the people they considered enemies. And they would quite often line them up in front of a slit trench and machine gun them so that they fell backward into this trench. And then the earth would be bulldozed over them to make a mass grave. And the Nazi high command expressed concern for what they called the burdening of the soul of their troopers who were doing the machine gunning. The burdening of the soul of the soldiers who were asked to kill these helpless people. I think that's something for us to think about. Paulo Freire, the Brazilian educator, says, to dehumanize another is to dehumanize ourselves. And I think that when we as a society stoop to the level of the least among us at his or her worst moment, we reduce our society to the level of that individual. the society in general. And from my perspective, seeing young American men who are now confessing to having tortured human beings in Iraq or Afghanistan, I see that this, to me, is the legacy of a society that suggests that when the superiors, when those in power say it's all right under certain circumstances to do harm and take a life, that slips into other areas. And we find ourselves facing the fact that we, as Americans, as believers in the decency and possibility of every human being, we are now condoning torture and brutality. We are now committing acts of political assassination. We are now doing things that it seems to me were very clearly thought of as anti-American years ago. Some say there is justification for it because of the exigencies of the time. I would argue that there's never justification for something like that, and that we are doing ourselves harm in the process. And I think, for me, one can be attached to the other. So what's happened today, and I want to just get to your questions. I don't know how much more time we have, but I want to get to your questions. What's happening today is that a group of organizations have come together and have determined that we want to replace the death penalty with life in prison without possibility of parole, and have put forward a bill, are putting forward today petitions that are available for signature that will put on the ballot in November 2012, a year from now, the proposition that the people of the state of California can replace the death penalty with life in prison without the possibility of parole. It will do more than that. It will take some of that $184 million every year, it'll take $30 million each year for 3 years, and give it to police forces to do what they have not been able to do so far. What a lot of you don't know, a lot of people in California don't know, is that 56% of the rapes that are committed in this state go unsolved every year. 46% of the murders in this state go unsolved every year. Saving that money and putting it to use, having police forces put it to use, can, with a specific job of closing these cold cases, these old unsolved cases, can do a lot more for bringing justice to this society than allowing this process to go forward that serves no purpose whatsoever. For those of you who want to know more about it, it's Safe California, www.safecalifornia.org. You can get more information about that a petition, more information about how to help, more information about what it is that this will do. But what it will do is save taxpayers money. It will use that money in a much more constructive way. It will ensure that people are put behind bars who commit these crimes for the rest of their natural lives and be required to stay there without the possibility of parole, unless, of course, later on they're proven to be innocent. Wouldn't that be nice? While they're incarcerated, they'll be required to work. And money that is raised from their work will go to either the victim's family or a victim's family fund. So there is a good that can come out of that. The other thing it does is protect innocent people who are wrongly convicted and sentenced. They will no longer be subject to death. They will be able to continue to try and demonstrate their innocence, as the two individuals I mentioned earlier have been able to do, thanks to the good work of some really caring people. So what we have is a sick situation that has created, a society that doesn't meet its own standards. And in so failing, I believe we have somehow confused the body politic, the people, to the degree that they are willing to listen when frightening things are said and discover for themselves something that really doesn't exist. Dr. George Gerbner, a social psychologist, I believe he was, coined the term the dangerous world syndrome. And he said, the dangerous world syndrome is something that's created by watching and ingesting all the stuff that comes over television and the radio about all the rapes and the murders and the onslaught and the ugliness and the horror that's being foist on the American people. He said, the dangerous world syndrome is to believe that this world that is being described for you out of the electronic media is the real world rather than the real world we know exists. And to begin to behave in a manner that suggests you are part of that world rather than this world. I think we are doing great harm to ourselves by continuing this retributive process that is doing that is shedding blood across the country. And it is shedding blood here, figuratively, of course, not usually, literally. And I think that we have an opportunity to do something about it with the Safe California Act, and I hope you'll give that your serious consideration. And if I may, I'd love to hear any questions you have. Oh, you know...
It's up to you.
It's up to me.
Just raise your hand.
You know, I can... Let me go through this quickly, but what I'd much prefer is hear you ask your questions than... I don't want to be frustrating to you because you've taken the time to write these things out. Let me just quickly run through these. Any idea of how many of the 3,000 on death row are seriously mentally ill? Human Rights Watch did a study recently that suggests that we have 250,000 demonstrably mentally ill people in our prisons generally. And that is more... mentally ill, demonstrably mentally ill people than we have in our mental institutions in this country. Now, we have in the back of the room, the kind man who introduced me is a psychologist who worked in the prisons, and he would be able to tell you that not only do we have mentally ill people who are there as a result of being mentally ill and committing a crime over which they had little control, but we are, through the process of the incarceration procedures we take today, particularly the solitary confinement for over long periods of time, we are creating mental illness. Yes, Pat, did you want to say?
I'd like to point out that 1 in 6 prisoners on death row in California have a serious diagnosis of serious mental illness.
1 in 6 of the 715 people, 14 people on death row in California have a diagnosable mental illness. And I don't know how many of them had that before they came to death row in California. The second part of that question is it's been suggested that 50% of those in criminal justice system are mentally ill. I'm not sure about 50%, but if you combine mental illness and nonviolent drug use, you have a significant majority, I think, of the people in our prisons today. How come some pro-life advocates are also pro-death penalty? Isn't all life equal? That's for them to answer. It's not a question that I probably can do getting into their minds. But I think I think an estimable position is to be in support of life generally. What do you say to the religious right wing who are for right to the same question? I wish you wouldn't support the death penalty. Why should someone who kills my husband, children, mom be allowed to live, never have to work, all meals served to them, and have visitors? The question is not why should that person be allowed to live. The question is why should we be required to kill? And it seems to me that a society, whether one is a Christian or a believer in some kind of philosophy, the question really comes back to what you believe, what is right. And if what you believe is that it is right to take a life, then I would argue, again, that you need to find a way to make the system that we use to take those lives perfect. Otherwise, you run the risk on the basis of your anger, frustration, rage at the death of your mother or your father, your sister, your brother, your son, your daughter, which I would share. If my wife or daughter were raped and murdered, I would want to strangle the son of a bitch who did it with my bare hands. But I don't want my society to be a retributive society, and I don't want to put the people in my society in the position of doing my killing for me. if we want to set up a system wherein the perpetrator is confronted by the nearest loved one of the victim, then you go back to the Romans, and it seems to me we have tried to come to a more civilized place than that. What do you consider to be the strongest argument in favor of retaining the death penalty, and how would you respond to it? I think the strongest argument in favor of the death penalty is that it meets the emotional need of the individual at that moment. I don't think, however, that we as a society should be put into that position. If we have a society that wants to raise itself, aspires to raise itself to a higher standard, then it seems to me that we have a decision to make, and one of it is to give up certain levels of freedom. I wear seatbelts in my car. I wear a helmet when I ride my motorcycle. I do that because it has been determined in our society that society suffers if I, riding a motorcycle, crash and have to have brain surgery and can't afford to pay for it, society suffers. So we, it seems to me, have a collective concern, and that is what we have to deal with. We have to deal with what we want our society to be. The Quakers, the American Friends Society, have done some fascinating work on penology. Look at their publications, good stuff. Quakers have a very interesting history. The penitentiary was a Quaker invention. It was to take somebody who did a harm and put him or her in a place of solitude to consider what they have done and to do penance. That concept has been terribly bastardized, I think, over time by people who don't quite see things the same way. But I quite agree with you. I think the American Friends Service Committee is a major supporter of, by the way, of Safe California Act. Osama bin Laden, he was murdered, but kind of like a death penalty. What do you think? I believe the president did exactly the wrong thing. He said, kill or capture. I think the people in SEAL Team 6 got the message, kill or capture. I believe that I wish the president had said, capture that man. Let's put him on trial and show the world that we are a nation of laws. We can demonstrate in such a doing, and by so doing, that we are not a vindictive people who say that what we should be doing to that bastard because he was responsible for this terrible thing, we can simply eliminate him, whether he's armed or not. I think it was a huge mistake. It used to be, before Osama bin Laden cropped into our lives, it used to be Adolf Hitler, that I think Adolf Hitler should not be killed. Yes, I believe Adolf Hitler was a sick man and should have been incarcerated for the rest of his natural life. And maybe we can learn something as a result of dealing with these people. I got some heat for saying that Timothy McVeigh should be put in a prison and kept there for the rest of his natural life, rather than being executed. I believe that we might have learned something from Timothy McVeigh about anybody who might have acted with him. And I also believe that by killing him, what we did was make him a hero in the mind's eye of certain demented people in our society who say he gave his life for his cause. I don't think we serve ourselves by elevating those malefactors, those bad actors, to positions of specialness by the way we treat them. So if anybody else has a question, I just sort of went through those quickly. If you have a question you'd like to actually ask with your voice, I'd be happy to. Yes, ma'am. The question is a good one. How does a sane and logical person believe you can teach somebody not to kill by killing? It's the conundrum that we discuss all the time. A friend of mine, a former Catholic priest, sent me a bumper sticker that said, I think Jesus meant when he said, love thy neighbor, don't kill him. I've said it before, but I'll say it again. State killing reduces the entire community to the level of its least member at his or her worst moment. Yes?
When an issue comes up where someone is the 139 that were not innocent, does anyone seem really concerned that the 139 people who actually committed the crime are still out there? It seems that if one is so afraid and so, vengeful, and so, if you're on that side, then shouldn't you be really worried about all of those people who have been out there for 20 years?
Well, there are two phenomena that play into that. One is because of the what I call the institutional imperative, the prosecutors who put that person behind bars and said that she or he committed that crime are quite often reluctant to admit having made a mistake. They will continue, as they have with Kirk Bloodsworth, as they have with Randy Steidel, as they have with many people I know who have been exonerated. They've continued to say, he got away with it. He got out on a technicality. He did the murder. Because they don't want to have to go back and say, I did my job poorly, or I did my job dishonestly. That's one problem. The other is people who are in fear, people who have been conditioned to live in fear of the other, are not necessarily the kind who want to analyze, to the degree you've just suggested, the how it plays out when somebody is freed from death row. We have many, many people in our circle, we as Death Penalty Focus, and Murder Victims' Families for Reconciliation and Murder Victims' Families for Human Rights, have many in our circle who are exonerees, they are some of the most courageous people I've ever run across, because they have been so harmed, done so much harm by our society, and yet instead of being angry and acting out their anger, they are committing themselves to the work that suggests that they want to make it a better society. I was heartbroken recently to learn that Dewayne McKinney, a man who was sentenced to, he wasn't sentenced to death, he was sentenced to life without parole for a murder that he didn't commit. He was freed after 20-some years. And he was given, because there is a law that allows some people to be remunerated for a certain amount of money for time spent. And he took that money and he invested it wisely and he made himself a millionaire. And he was tremendously, tremendously generous with his money. And he was always came to our events and he would speak on behalf of the organization and talk about his experience and say, this is a society that gives that has done harm, but we can make it a better society by acknowledging that harm and trying to figure out ways in which to make to limit the way these errors take place. Dewayne was killed in an automobile accident last year, and it just breaks my heart that somebody who went through what he went through and became what he became. His life ended that way, but we don't have, I guess, or I don't have those answers as to how and why these things happen. Yes, sir.
Yes, thanks. I'm wondering how can we get back to 1972, and what's the most compelling argument for Americans and. What does it take to get us back there, and when can we get there?
Well, here in California, we can get there next year. We can get there when enough people stand up and vote to replace the death penalty with life without parole. And what I think that will do, what I haven't mentioned, or maybe I did and I forgot, since the reinstatement in 1976, 38 states were killing states. In the last 6 years, four of those states have changed. New York, New Jersey, New Mexico, and Illinois have all given up the death penalty. New York on a judiciary, by the judiciary. New Jersey, New Mexico, and Illinois by legislative fiat. The people of the state were led by their legislatures to say, this is not serving us, and we therefore give it up. I believe if California, here in California, the problem is that the governor doesn't have the power to do that and the legislature doesn't have the power to do that. It's the people, because the current law that kills, that sets up our death penalty system, was put into place by the initiative process. So the only way it can be retaken down is by the initiative process. But I think that when California does this, and we have a firm belief that we have the opportunity to do this next November, when California does this, California is a bellwether state, and there are many states that will follow. And if it were left up to the Supreme Court as constituted today, I don't think we would have a repeat of 1972. I think the Supreme Court as constituted today is far less sensitive to the to justice issues, frankly. But they will be put in a position when enough states have declared their opposition by doing away with their death systems. They will be put in a position that they were a few years back with the, I believe it was the Simmons decision that said that people under the age of 18, children who were convicted of capital crimes, could no longer be executed. When enough states took that position, the Supreme Court said, it is the will of the people, and we will therefore rule that no state should have the right to kill those who were children when they committed capital crimes. We can come to that point. And it may be dragging those justices kicking and screaming into the reality that the people of the United States of America simply don't want to continue to kill their citizens when it's cheaper, smarter, safer, and better to not do so. Yes, ma'am. It's very hard to know. The opposition, you know, one of the problems with an initiative campaign in California is that we are such a large state that it requires a media campaign, and that's very expensive. So we know it's fair to assume that the District Attorneys Association will oppose us. It's fair to assume that certain police organizations will oppose us, although we have now over 100 law enforcement officers, judges, prosecutors, and people from various walks of life in the law enforcement community who have come out in support of our position. It's hard to know who will be the primary funder for the opposition. Maybe there won't be one. Wouldn't that be nice? Yes, in the back. No, it's okay. He was just going to say we have to finish now, so if you have a question. The Safe California Act will call for the replacement of the death penalty with life in prison without possibility of parole. If it is passed, that will become the law.
Oh, right. But then it's not. It's contingent upon a lawful still. It's contingent about someone being arrested.
No.
Can it be overturned? Is what you just said after that?
No. The only way it can be overturned is through another initiative process or through the state legislature saying, I suppose, well, we love the death penalty and we want to do it. But I don't think once the people speak, any legislative body is going to say, well, the people are wrong, we need the death penalty. If the initiative passes, I can't tell you what number it will be on the ballot. I wish I could. But when the Safe California Act passes, it becomes the law. I suppose there's a process by which it has to, constitutionality has to be tested. But as far as I know, it becomes the law virtually immediately. And we will then empty our death row, and we will not be a killing state any longer. To do what?
To not have the death penalty.
Right. That's correct. We have one more. Okay, and this gentleman actually up here. One more. I'm sorry. 51%? Yeah. Or 50.1, I think it is. Yeah. And yes, sir. Just a couple more questions, evidently. This gentleman had his hand up a moment ago.
The Prison Guard Association is one of the biggest lobbyists in the state.
Yes.
You
know, the Prison Guard Association is in question. I'm not sure how it affects their job one way or the other to have a death row or not have a death row. The Prison Guard Association also is embroiled in a lawsuit now that may mean that it's not beneficial for them to be involved, or maybe they won't be able to afford to be involved. But we've already had one meeting with the Prison Guards Association and hope to have more, to explain to them that there is great value to the entire community, and including them. That, you know, prison guards aren't too happy with the idea of having to take somebody into a room and strap him or her down and kill them. This is a deeply painful process, and I will tell you from personal experience that I know many people who have been involved in this process over time who have had to have therapy, as a result of having been part of this thing. And there's a gentleman who was involved for a long period of time in Texas who has retired, and he talks about dreams where he sees the eyes of the people he killed, where he sees the faces of the people he killed, the chaplain, the former chaplain in Texas, who was a death penalty supporter, wrote a book, and there's been a documentary film made about him saying, I discovered the damage I was doing to myself and to all of the other people in the system by this process. We have a very courageous woman four rows behind you who was the warden at San Quentin and presided over four executions, who has come out now and is the executive director of Death Penalty Focus, saying we should end this process. So it's the Correctional Officers Association is certainly a factor to be concerned about in the politics of this state. But I'm not absolutely sure they're going to be against us. Yes, ma'am.
So my question would be, in addition to signing the petition, what other things can we start doing to actually move this forward? I hear so many things today with politics and the war, et cetera, and I'm like, give me some answers about what I can do besides just sign a petition.
Take a petition and get other people to sign it.
All right.
And you can go to safecalifornia.org, and they will give you a way to get to as many petitions as you can. And then go, I'm going to speak to a group Thursday night in Riverside County, and there will be a person there with petitions saying anybody who wants to sign up can sign up. I'm going to speak to another group a couple of weeks from then, and everywhere I go, I'm going to want to have people with petitions for those signatures.
Mr. So, Carroll, I think we have time for one more question as well.
Oh, okay.
What's the latest time we have to submit the petitions?
The petitions have to be in by the end of February, because they have to be all resolved and validated and counted and processed. We are our goal is to get 750,000 petitions signed, valid petitions signed, signatures. I'm sorry, because we need a little over 500,000 to qualify. But you always have duplications, and you have people who sign incorrectly, and you have those kinds of problems. But our intention, and we have now money in the war chest to get it done, the intention is to have these signatures, petitions, all in by the end of February.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're very kind to have come.
And incidentally, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Farrell's a wonderful author. I've read his books, and they're for sale out there. If you'd like to buy one and have it signed by him, you could do that as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, all of you.